Time to play. CKUT is having a funding drive. CKUT is your community radio supporting events.
Walk with us on Saturday, June 11th at 1 p.m. Join us for the 8th Annual Spirit Walk on beautiful Mount Royal. The Spirit Walk is an annual fundraiser for the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, Poyipo Fam. Register to walk and set a personal goal to fundraise for the shelter. All funds go directly to the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal towards their second stage housing project and Saradikitak Social Pediatric Clinic. Join us for fun, community-driven, even including musical performances generously supported by CKUT. Everyone is welcome. Bring your friends, family, and pets and come walk with us. Follow our Instagram at SpiritWalkMTL for links to register and for more information.
Previously broadcast program.
Welcome to another episode of Pirate Block Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM. Talking to you is your host, as always, Malta Leander. For those of you who have not tuned into Pirate Block Radio before, this is a show coming out of Jejage, also known as Montreal, located on unceded Indigenous lands. We are focusing the topics of discussion to be around new media and digital arts, somewhere in the crossroads of science, technology, and innovation, together with local and emerging artists. Today, I'm speaking to a few of the Art Vault residents developing projects over the next few months at Eastern Bloc. First off, we have Diana Matasheva, Uzbek multimedia artist exploring topics such as digital surrealism, hyperreality, and experimental narratives through clever blends of photography and graphic design. With her project Familiar Faces, she is exploring neural networks to create AI-generated photographs that challenges the anti-LGBTQ+ laws in Uzbekistan by morphing already existing photographs of Uzbek people with hints and traits from the queer communities, resulting in new yet familiar faces. Thanks for being here today, Diana. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
So could you just talk to us a little bit more about what this work entails, apart from the short summary that I gave here?
If I had to give a one-liner, it would be I'm trying to create a utopian AI-generated community of queer people from Uzbekistan, bonded by common aesthetics, but not bearing human consciousness. So basically, I'm trying to create a community in the virtual reality with no reference to an actual community. Thus creating something that is in itself, I guess, a simulation or a simulacrum. I'm not sure, like, I can't, I'm not sure whether it actually challenges the anti-LGBTQ plus laws in Uzbekistan, because I have no control over how my project will be perceived and what its influence will actually be. I can only talk about, I guess, my impression of it and or my intention about making it. And my intention is to create this community that I had never access, I never had access to. So create something that had never existed in my childhood or adulthood. I grew up in Uzbekistan. I spent 18 years there. So I think that I'm trying to dig deep in my memory of what Uzbekistan represents for me, and reconcile my memories with my beliefs about what the ideal community is for me. And at the end of the day, I call it utopian, but it's rather dystopian. Because, yeah.
Right. Yeah, perhaps commenting is a better choice of words than challenging the laws. But I understand that there's a quite the small queer Uzbek community, and perhaps even more so looking at Canada. And so this idea that you're describing of sort of filling the gap, I guess, of Uzbek queerness, which, as you're saying, holds both utopian and dystopian narratives, is to me particularly interesting, I think. Can you talk a bit more about this?
Yeah, sure. Okay, let me tell you, it's not going to be the answer to your question. It's related to your question, but it's not necessarily the answer. I talked to my mom recently, and I told her, and she is in Kazakhstan right now, which is the country close to Uzbekistan, with sort of similar values, but way more progressive. So my mom, I told her about my project, and she's like, well, why are you making this project? Because for her, it seemed a little bit too representational. And I'm like, well, I guess just the fact that I haven't been to Uzbekistan for so long just makes me want to reach out for it, at least aesthetically or artistically. And I also told her that people here are not familiar with Uzbekistan, and they often confuse Uzbekistan for Russia, and, you know, I am often called Eastern European instead of Central Asian and stuff like that. And I'm not offended by it. Of course, it's like people don't have to know geography. But I sometimes have a desire to illustrate my past and my culture when I speak about it. And I guess that's where my intention is coming from. But then my mom asked me, okay, she said, I understand this desire to educate people and make them familiar with your culture. But then why queer? And isn't that kind of like, I don't know. It's like, why queer? And, you know, I had a hard time answering this question, because I think maybe queer because it's something natural to me, and that's like a point of liberation for me here in Canada. Maybe something that I really appreciate about Canada is me being able to express myself and be myself, as cheesy as it may sound. And I have never been able to do it neither in Uzbekistan nor in Russia. And I guess that's why it is queer. And it is dystopian because, first of all, it doesn't exist. And it's a figment of my imagination and something that is that idealistic and in nature and has no reference points is by definition dystopian for me, because mm-hmm. it's unachievable. And so it's like it's like, I don't know, it's like those commercials where everyone is smiling and, you know, family members are put together only by their aesthetic qualities. Like all of them have blue eyes and white hair, and that's why they're acting as a family, but they actually don't even know each other's names, you know? And even though it's supposed to represent some utopian idea of a family, it's actually pretty dystopian. So I feel like that's how I see my project as well.
I think that's, yeah, that's a good picture that you paint there. And it is a pretty crazy in-between point when those two sides can exist at the same time.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the angle, right?
Well, I'm curious to hear about the pictures that you'd be choosing to feed into these neural networks as part of the work. How do you go about choosing those, or what are the ideas or intentions behind that?
Well, I don't know if you've ever been on a website, thispersondoesntexist.com. And it's basically like AI generated faces. And whenever you refresh the page, the new face pops up and you look at it. And sometimes you can't believe that this is not a real face because it doesn't have any artifacts or anything. It looks very real. But then you refresh the page another time and there's going to be like some like ugly artifact and like a person would lack and like a feature, or will have like an extra eye or something, and you understand that this is machine learning. But but all these images, like, they are kind of like devoid of ethnicity. Like, I mean, you can guess that they belong to, like, I don't know, they're Europeans sometimes, and sometimes they're Asian, but rarely do you see people from other ethnicities. And I wanted to create something that is ethnicity specific. So for that, I decided to download lots of pictures from Google of Uzbek people. And it's as easy as like writing Uzbek people, or writing it in Russian, like Uzbek, Uzbechka, and then going through all these images. And I can verify whether people look Uzbek or not. Like, of course, if someone doesn't, like, I would discard this image. So I would download all of those stock photos. And then I have like numerous self-portraits, and I would also feed them to the machine. Then I have my relatives' photos, my dad's photos. And so each portrait is going to contain like those like stock images of Uzbek people from the internet, my own image, and my family members. So ultimately it's going to be my self-portrait with a mixture of some other
people. Merged with other random Uzbek people.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. But it's like, you know, that's how like, it reminds me of how our dreams work. You know, you can't, when you dream of someone, you can't really remember their face perfectly. It's some face that you can't pinpoint who it belongs to, what features it has. So I think I'm trying to achieve something like that. It's going to be vaguely familiar, and it's going to vaguely represent me, but also contain lots of other features that are unidentifiable. Sorry, English.
Yeah, I like that idea of the dream world, because I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's always a blurry mess of a mixture and a merge of three different people, one that you've seen on the street, two good friends, and someone else. It's always an in-between point.
Exactly.
Also part of the AI or the system that you're feeding the photographs in is using what is called GAN, a generative adversarial network. Could you, because this was the first time I encountered it, could you explain a little bit what that is?
Yeah, can I read what it is? And if it's not understandable, I'll try to summarize it. Is that fine?
Yeah, go ahead.
So GANs are a clever way of training a generative model by framing the problem as a supervised learning problem with two submodels, the generator model that we train to generate new examples and the discriminator model that tries to classify examples as either real from the domain or fake generated. The two models are trained together in a zero-sum game, adversarial, until the discriminator model is fooled about the half the time, meaning the generator model is generating plausible examples. So now I'm going to explain. So there are two models. One is creating fakes, basically, and another model is recognizing these fakes. And whenever the first model is able to fool the second model half of the time, let me give an example of faces. Let's start over. So GAN is it contains two models within it. So one is creating, for example, fake faces, and the second one is recognizing whether they're fake or not. And then at the moment that the first program is able to produce a face that the second program can't recognize as a fake, we receive this person doesn't exist face.
Okay.
Which is completely AI generated, has no features of anyone, reminds of everyone, but no one at the same time.
So sort of like surpasses a threshold where it's valid enough to be a fake face. The result
Comes
out kind of.
Yes.
Interesting.
That's from what I am understanding. But again, like I'm not I have very little knowledge about how the machines work. I just use them. Like, you know, you don't need to know how electricity works to turn on the light bulb. So
plug something into the wall.
Yeah. So I really don't think that I need to know in depth how it works, as long as it works for me, as long as I conceptually understand what it means. Like,
for sure.
So I just like the metaphor. I like the fact that you are feeding this network, let's say 1,000 faces, right? And then it creates new faces on the basis of those 1,000 faces. And then the second network is like, no, this one is too close to real. Yes, this one is not close to real. And then you have this ideal AI generated face. So I like the idea of it. I think conceptually it's very strong.
Great. Have you worked with these tools in the past, or is this a new skill set that you're developing and exploring?
I have never worked with this tool. I actually, for fun, I replaced people's faces with faces from this person doesn't exist. Because also, like, you know, if you expose someone's face, you have to ask this person to be able to use their image in certain contexts. So then you have to sign the release form, and it all gets really complicated. So if you use an AI generated face, you don't actually have to sign any release forms and don't have to worry about legal obligations. So I did that. I did that before. But I have never really created my own set of faces. My friend used to work with this tool, but for videos. And that what got me really interested, because the results were kind of like fascinating body horror, like weird stuff. And I thought I want to do something like that.
I bet. Yeah. So this is still conceptual, since you're starting the residency in a bit, but are you at the later part of a stage, will you be completely relying upon this system, or will you have some, control over the learning process, or even doing personal touch-ups on the AI, sort of collaborating with the result, or are you just relying upon what the artificial intelligence is feeding you?
Oh, I always collaborate with the machines. I never give them full control, because I do think it's a little dangerous. Of course, I'm going to be using Photoshop at the end, and I'm going to modify certain features that because I want to, yes, it's true, I want to have control over what I create. And certain parts of the of the series are going to be shot. So, you know, body parts are going to be shot. And even though later I will feed them to Gunn to generate the new body on the basis of like my body and some other people, I actually haven't figured it out yet. But eventually, like, I will probably remove some artifacts that make it like unbearable to look at. I will probably add some aesthetic elements. Some cultural elements probably too. Maybe tattoos, maybe some decor, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah. We'll see as it develops. I'm curious to
I'm also to see curious.
How the project continues to take shape.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm also curious. I have no idea if it's going to work out. I have no guarantee, but I guess it's like a fun experiment.
That's definitely part of it too.
Yeah.
Well, some themes that generally that you touch upon in your work is migration and trans identities and online fetishes and other adjacent areas that's in some ways relate to familiar faces as well. In what way would you say that that this project is moving in a new direction in your practice, or perhaps a familiar one, like apart from these neural networks that we've spoken about now? Is there a specific part that you're particularly excited about or that you see moving forward?
I'm excited about the aesthetics. I actually care about the aesthetics the most. I guess I'm always very thrilled to see the result. I want to see the, because ideas are, you know, in my head and we talk about it, we can read about them, we can write them down, but it's not as exciting as seeing them visualized. So I'm done with the conceptual part of it. We've already discussed what it means, and I guess it does bleed into some subjects that I explored in the past, like migration or online fetishes. But right now, I wanted to look beautiful. You know, that's kind of all I want. Now my goal is to make it look so good that you can believe that it's true, that the community actually exists, or that the person in front of you actually exists. I just want to create this like hyper real image that you wish existed. And you like, of course, it's like, it's very ambitious of what I'm saying, but it's in the ideal world. If I had enough tools, if I had enough money, if I, you know, had enough time, I would create something similar to like an icon that you can worship. Like I'm very much into religious imagery that you look at and you feel the sublime, you feel like you want to worship this image, you want to be around this image, you want to cry. That's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in exploring the emotion behind it.
I think that resonates with me too. Like why put the bar low for a project that touches upon a lot of themes and topics that like close to you and that are personal as well. Yeah, I'm curious to hear a little bit perhaps on what the influences are, or what you mentioned before our talk that you had a couple of things in mind perhaps that has inspired you or other people or artists. So I'm curious to see where some of those thoughts have come from.
I guess there's so many. I don't want to sound pretentious while name dropping.
It could be a specific project as well. I thought you had mentioned something that sort of related to, so that works as well. You don't have to do a list of your top five favorites either. So it was mostly if there was something in common that had sort of kickstarted, or that you've gotten ideas from that fed into the ideas that came from this project, I guess, or led up to this project.
Okay, that's easier. Narrows it down. There are two photographers that I really love. It's Jeff Wall and Nikki S. Lee. And Nikki S. Lee has this project called Projects, where she becomes a part of different communities. And she completely changes her appearance and lives with those communities for a bit and then takes a photograph with them, like a candid photograph. And then Jeff Wall, he has different kinds of images, but the ones that I'm inspired by particularly are the ones that he completely constructs. For example, there is an image, I forgot how it's called, but it's a line in front of a club, a line of people just waiting to come into the club. And it looks like a candid image, like a documentary style photograph. And then you read about it and you realize that he constructed it completely, that all of those people are actors and that the image is actually a digital composite. And it's like a few different images combined into one, you know, and then it kind of like messes with your perception of reality a little bit. So that's the second one. And I guess also general ideas of Jean Baudrillard and his ideas on hyperreality, simulation, and simulacrum. And like this periphery between the real and the imaginary, and like the absence of reference, iconography, and
yeah, those are some great references that I'll have to look up. I mean, I find your project really interesting. So having something that for you has brought ideas that has fed into some of the things that you've had in mind when conceptualizing this is definitely something that I want to check out as well. You also mentioned that you perhaps had a quote that gave some context to either to the piece or to the creative process. Is that something that you would want to share?
It's so long. I realized that I would be reading it for like a minute or two. It's long and it's complicated, and it will make me sound pretentious. But I had to read it 5 times to understand it myself.
That's okay.
Okay, well, let's try it. And stop me at any point. I won't take it personally. Okay. So, well, first of all, the context. I'll give you the definition to what iconoclasm and iconolatry means. So iconoclasts are people who are destroying religious imagery, such as icons, and iconolaters are people who worship icons. So ones are destroying, other ones are worshiping. So this is precisely because they, iconoclasts, people who destroy religious imagery, predicted this omnipotence of simulacra, the faculty simulacra have of effacing God from the conscious of man, and the destructive, annihilating truth that they allow to appear, that deep down God never existed, that only the simulacrum ever existed, even that God himself was never anything but his own simulacrum. From this came their urge to destroy the images. If they could have believed that these images only obfuscated and masked the Platonic idea of God, there would have been no reason to destroy them. One can live with the idea of distorted truth, but their metaphysical despair came from the idea that the image didn't conceal anything at all, and that these images were in essence not images such as an original model would have made them, but perfect simulacra forever radiant with their own fascination. Thus, this death of their divine referential must be exercised at all costs. So basically, he's saying that iconoclasts are trying to destroy iconography because they understand that it conceals the meaninglessness. Instead of, like, they don't believe that there's actually a reference to the divine. They understand that the iconography is the divine itself. So by destroying it, they kind of probably trying to fight with this existential angst that they have, with this like religious despair that they have, with this godlessness. I actually have the quote continue, so I'll read it till the end, and then I'll explain what I meant with that. So one can see that iconoclasts, whom one accuses of disdaining and negating images, were those who accorded them their true value, in contrast to the iconolaters, who only saw reflections in them and were content to venerate a filigree god. On the other hand, one can say that the icon worshippers were the most modern minds, the most adventurous, because in the guise of having God become apparent in the mirror of images, they were already enacting his death and his disappearance in the epiphany of his representations, which perhaps they already knew no longer represented anything, that they were purely a game, but that it was therein the great game lay, knowing also that it is dangerous to unmask images since they dissimulate the fact that there's nothing behind them. So then he's comparing it to iconolaters who, even though probably suspecting that there is nothing behind the iconography they are worshiping, they're yet ready to worship the iconography for what it is and not what it refers to. It's kind of like in Russian, we have an expression coming from like this famous Russian poet who's saying, you can cry over the imaginary. And you know, sometimes you read the book and you identify with it to the point that you start crying. Or you believe that what's happening in the TV screen is true to the point that you have like a heartache whenever a person is dying on the screen. Or like, you know, you have this empathic response to something that actually has no reference to real life. Right. And I think this ability of human beings to identify with the complete simulacrum and worship the simulacrum fascinates me. And I do want to, and that's why I want to create the community with no reference, the community that can move and create an emotional response without even existing
exactly.
in real life.
Mm-hmm. So. I can definitely see the linkages between those two, or the quote and the thoughts behind it. Well, I very much look forward to seeing where all this is going to take you and the project itself as well. And for all the listeners out there, make sure to keep an eye on the Eastern Bloc channels, as there will be a sort of a pop-up showcase with the Artvolt residents where Diana is going to be part of as well in the month of June. So yeah, keep an eye on the Eastern Bloc channels for more updates around that. Thanks so much, Diana, for joining in and talking about your work.
Thank you.
Take care, and I'll see you around soon.
See you around, and have a wonderful day.
Next up from the Art Vault residence is Ruzbe Shadpei, artist and musician with one foot in the world of academic training in psychiatry and medicine, whilst having the other in research creation-based projects in sound, image, and avant-garde electronic music. His work that he's currently undertaking at Eastern Bloc is titled M2A, Cosmotechnics of E-Viscerality, explores the pill cam, a pill-sized video camera, essentially a biomedical repackaging of military camera technology. He does this through a practice-based research approach that questions the contextualization of this piece of tech in the global north as opposed to its original use. Thanks, Ruzbe, for speaking with me today. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So part of this work was, as you mentioned just before our talk here, was originally a lecture performance as part of the programming of the Mosaic Rooms in London. And now you're working on a second part, a sort of video essay of or to this project. Can you talk a bit more about this development or where you're currently at, I guess, and give some context to the listeners apart from the short introduction that I did there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the video essay was the original plan for the Eastern Bloc residency, but it changed quite a bit. So I had researched PILCAM a year ago, kind of fortuitously. I fell upon it while researching neuroimaging and some other things, and then I discovered this pill. I dug deeper, and it was also in the context of last May and a moment when Palestine was kind of erupting into speakability and visibility and the global stage, if you will, which felt quite exciting. And it felt like there would be a shift. And unfortunately, a lot of things have gone back to the way they were now. But I was researching PILCAM then, but it's just stuff that were kind of in my notes that I didn't really think I would do anything with. And then around the new year, a curator at the Mosaic Rooms contacted me because they were doing, they wanted to create the public programming for their show that was called Gut Feelings, on the themes of viscerality, both anatomically and affectively, if you will. And the neurological and kind of the scientific and the medical aspect of it was something that they were interested in. So when they came to me and asked me if I had any work about it, well, I said, yes, I have exactly kind of, I know exactly what I want to create work about. And so I dug back into this PILCAM research, and what became clear was this notion that there was a cosmotechnics, which is a term I borrow from the philosopher, the Hong Konger philosopher of technique, Yu Kui, who writes about cosmotechnics as basically a way of thinking about the cosmologies that each piece of technology encapsulates within it, and what specific technology reveals kind of about the world at a greater scale, both morally, ethically, and whatnot. So that's kind of the framework I use to think about this work, which is where the title comes from.
Right.
I created this lecture performance. Lecture performance is a medium that I like a lot because it's delightfully vague. it's everything,
a lot of different things.
And anything. Yeah, it could be anything. And I like it because it allows me to work with text, reading and performing text, and also to kind of have creative visual material and sound material as well. So that's what I wanted to develop in at Eastern Bloc, is kind of the visual aspect of it, if you will. And I ended up creating kind of a PowerPoint, which sounds really like funny to say, like, you know, I made an artistic PowerPoint, but it's kind of what I did. I ended up refining the text because the residency kind of overlapped with the last 3 weeks before the performance. So I ended up having to kind of tighten up the text a lot, working on the PowerPoint. And then the last week I had some free time because I had finished kind of the text and the PowerPoint. And so I thought, I'm going to explore, just experiment kind of materially with some of the themes that came up during the research. And so I started making these objects, like making these pills, but also doing these exercises of writing on different materials that were not paper and that reacted variously to water and whatnot. And it ended up creating these appendages to the research, but I still don't know what I'm going to do with those and if I'm going to do anything with those. Yeah.
I mean, everything's a work in progress until you decide that there's an end point. So
yeah.
For good and bad, perhaps. But could you perhaps give a bit of explanation around this technology or the context of the PILCAM? Because, some listeners might get a visual of just this, well, basically what the title of it or the name of it, a PILCAM, a very small one. But could you give a bit of context on how that is used and your reflections upon a change in use, I guess, in different geographical locations as well, in different contexts that it's being used and has in the past?
Yeah, for sure. So PILCAM is what you would call in medicine video capsule endoscopy. And it's quite self-explanatory. It's a camera that's shrinked and encapsulated in a pill. and that's swallowed by the patient. And it's an alternative to traditional endoscopy. And it's considered a minimally invasive alternative to traditional endoscopy in the sense that, you know, you're not putting a scope down somebody's throat or up somebody's ass. Like, they're just swallowing a pill with a glass of water, and then it travels inside them, you know, naturally goes through the entire digestive tract, and it exits them. But while it's doing this, it's taking pictures, and it's creating, in real time, the patient is wearing a kind of computer on them. And in real time, these pictures are being transmitted to the computer, which is recreating them into a video. So you end up getting what you would get with the normal endoscopy, which is a video of the digestive tract, but with a lot less of the hassle and the discomfort. And what was for me kind of the starting point of this research and this project is when I found out that the pill cam was invented by an Israeli military scientist called Gabriel Adan, who 30 years prior had created what's known as the seekers, the missile seeker, which is called the eye of the missile in some spaces. It's a camera that's the organ of sight of the missile. It allows it to direct itself to its prey. And Adan created this in the 70s and the 80s, you know, in occupied Palestine, tested on Palestinians and their maiming and their killing. And this camera, 20 years after, he decided to kind of venture in the area of biomedicine and biotech. And he essentially just shrank that camera using miniaturization technology by NASA. And in 2000, he had a pill, which he actually, I don't know if he does, but a lot of Israeli media calls the missile pill. Yeah, so this is the missile pill. It is the pill cam. And what became interesting for me is to think about, you know, how, because there's this line that kind of like I come back to in the work, and this is the CEO of Given Imaging, that's the company that Adan created to create the pill cam, which was initially known as M2A. But it's this line he says, and he says it's like swallowing a missile that doesn't explode. That's what he says. And, you know, of course you think, well, actually that missile does explode and did explode in a lot of circumstances. But the question becomes, well, what dictates why and when it explodes versus when it doesn't explode? And what does that tell us about the viscerality of certain people in kind of this cosmotechnics of imperialism and colonialism, where the lives, the death of Palestinians under Israeli occupation is recycled into a tool that is used for the surveillance of the health of people living in, you know, the global north or in Israel. So that was kind of the big question at the heart of it. Yeah.
It's quite a quote to describe it. I mean, at the same time trying to frame that as a non-obtrusive or invasive alternative, and then sort of having that staple with that quote kind of goes against that in a way. I mean, that's Yeah, with this tool being used in other contexts outside of Palestinians, being used in the past, that you're saying now that it is perhaps a globally used tool in medicine, do you believe that there's a possibility of using this technology in a non or decolonialist way, considering the original context of use, and how would one go about that in that case?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And that's kind of one of the interventions the work is trying to make, is that it takes on different perspectives, the work does. And one of them is the perspective of the patient, like the, you know, the North American patient that goes to the doctor because, you know, they're bleeding in their gut and they get offered like this intervention, you know. And I mean, the answer to that, first of all, is to say that this, I refuse to to separate the pill cam from the missile seeker, you know, to delineate it in a way that this is like its shameful past, you know, and now it's this ingenious medical invention. Because the truth is that the violence that created the seeker's missile and that created pill cam is an ongoing violence. So there's no past or present or future here. This is the same timeline. And, you know, knowing that, then it raises questions to the patient. It raises, you know, this notion of what is your relationship to having this tool of violence inside you, literally traveling inside you? You know, how does that make you feel? Do you not, you know, what's your ethical duty like in that circumstance? And not only just your ethical duty, but, you know, modern medicine might not say that there is any risk of taking the pill cam, you know, but I don't know, one has to think that this is a camera see and cameras remember. And, you know, there was this notion of the memory of technology. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, well, you know, what does this pill remember? It remembers what it has seen. It remembers, you know, and all of that is going inside you. Like, you know, there isn't a simple answer to that. I guess what I'm calling for is to refuse the pill cam, you know, in a way to mm-hmm. boycott the pill cam. Mm-hmm. But this is, it's complex. You know, this is people's health, this is well-being. Some people might need the pill cam because traditional endoscopy also can't go everywhere in the gut.
Right.
So there's some indications where pill cam is really the only way. That being said, there are different technologies of video capsule endoscopy, but that are less prominent in North America. Pill cam is very much the global standard in North America, but I know that in Japan, and I think in other places in Europe and Asia, there are alternatives to video capsule endoscopy. And I haven't had the time to go into those to see like what the companies are that made those and what technologies they use. But, you know, a kind of a simple, practical answer might be, well, investing in those other pills, like pill cameras that are not pill cam, you know, that mm-hmm. come from other mm-hmm. places. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and when mentioning risks, those are perhaps first and foremost thought of physical and medical risks, and not really about, as you said, moral risks or a conscience repercussion or consequence coming later on if choosing that as an alternative.
Yeah. But you know, but that's why viscerality became a fertile terrain to have this conversation in, because it is the kind of the natural meeting point of the affective and the psychic and the flesh and the body. You know, the visceral is as much the internal organs as it is kind of the gut feeling, you know, the thing that affects you unmediated in an unmediated way. So what I liked about situating this whole thought experiment in the guts was that it undid this binary of you know, the medical physical health and the kind of the moral, the conscious affective health. Like mm-hmm. it blurred it, and so it became inextricable one from the other. Yeah,
that's interesting, the overlapping thoughts of different themes and thematics that this touches upon when reflecting upon all of these different sides and aspects to the project. Mm-hmm. Your other work tends to navigate areas of decolonial practices and technologies, illness and fatigue, amongst other related topics. Would you say that this project moves in a new direction for you artistically or in the creative process, perhaps? And if so, how?
Yeah. I think it's an extension of, like you said, a lot of the themes that I've been thinking about and working through in the past, you know, couple of years. But it does go in different spaces. I mean, one of the new directions in which it brought me was working in a more literary sphere, because the text itself is quite scripted and literary, and it almost unfurls, like it has an element of theatricality to it, because it unfurls in five acts, and each act has its protagonist. So there's the patient, there's the prisoner, there's the colonizer, and then there's the patient again, but that comes back like the power of refusal. So it had this like literary theatrical element, and I also went and I brought in references that were more literary and less academic and theoretic than I usually do. And that's not true; they're still academic, but literary references, and the style of writing is less theoretical as it is literary. So I think that was important for me to, because oftentimes, you know, these theoretical works are very heavy, can be very heavy. They're densely packed with research and material. And so I wanted to be able to convey that this time around in a way that one, you know, and anybody could kind of read or listen to and would get something out of it. Like I didn't want it to feel like homework. I wanted it to feel like a beautiful text, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is a direction that I'm going to keep on exploring. I'm thinking about writing a play, again, like bringing in all the research and the image and the sound and whatever, but then exploring it like through kind of the conventions of a script and a play. And so, yeah, I think it is kind of spearheading me in a direction.
Yeah, that's great. Catching different ends and then sometimes contextualizing them in existing frameworks is exactly what you need to sort of get something more concrete to grasp or adapt to. Well, you also have a considerable amount of experience as a composer and sound artist. Mm. So I'm curious to hear how sound exists within this work, perhaps in particular.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. Is the answer. It doesn't at all.
Because I thought I had the idea of there being perhaps recorded interviews, or perhaps this was at an early stage, yeah, that there was a description of that element being present. Well, perhaps, yeah, for future iterations, as we said, everything's an ongoing project until, yeah, you decide it not, yeah, to be.
Yeah, totally. That was an idea that I had, and I still like that idea, but we'll see. I mean, I said it doesn't, but that's not true, because the text is made to be read, and I did read it, and I do, you know, and I think this is maybe somewhere where dogmatic sound artists, you know, might draw a line and be like, well, orally performing isn't a sound practice, but why not? You know, yeah, there's. Uh-huh. But you know, I'm very much a non-dogmatic sound artist, so yeah, I have no qualms with referring to reading mm-hmm. as sound art. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm also curious. Obviously, the pill cam was sort of an object in itself that sparked inspiration for this project. But I'm curious to hear what kind of other influences or themes that has affected you as of lately, or perhaps in the process of working with this project being the most recent.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many influences, really. let me think about them. Well, one of them was thinking about cameras, you know, thinking about the image, which is not something that I, that comes to me intuitively, being somebody that comes from the realm of sound. You know, the image is something I use more utilitarianly, or in a utilitarian fashion, I should say. But this time around, I really had to think kind of theoretically about the image and the camera. And so I read up on Ariella Azoulay, who's an Israeli anti-Zionist writer, theorist, who thinks a lot about the image, and particularly in the context of Palestine. So her work was helpful. I also delved into psychoanalysis because I love it. And, you know, we were in the guts, we were in the viscera. And so I delved into psychoanalysis, particularly this book called Psychoanalysis Under Occupation, Practicing Resistance in Palestine, which was made by this couple. One of them is a psychoanalyst, the other is a theorist. They're both Lebanese. They're called Lara and Stephen Shihai. And they wrote this brilliant book about psychoanalytical practices in occupied Palestine. And that was very informative and nourished the writing quite a bit. Shalal Tufik is another writer who I revisited, thinking about his thoughts on psychosis and organs and delusions of nihilism. I thought about Daniel Paul Schreiber, who wrote this like memoir of nervous illness in the 1880s. He was a German jurist. His work is one of the seminal works of psychiatric autoethnography.
Okay.
Freud got really interested in it, and he became kind of a staple of that. But he's somebody I visited because he had this delusional thinking that he didn't have any organs. So that was something I wanted to think about. But yeah, Mikhail Bakhtin too, who's the Russian literary critique who wrote a lot about the grotesque and viscerality, and he thought about viscerality and the viscera as not this place of like enclosedness and separation, but as a place of radical interconnection with the world. You know, the world which passes through the mouth and the anus constantly, kind of, it's the outside within. So he was an interesting person to have in the fold. But yeah, I could go on the list.
I hear you. Yeah, interesting to hear that you have such a rich library of sources that you can take from and map your inspirations to as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I want to thank you, Ruzbe, for coming in and talking a bit about your project, and we'll see what shape it takes as a final form. I'm looking forward to hearing more about it moving onwards.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, make sure to keep your eyes peeled on the Eastern Bloc channels and on Ruzbe Shadpei. This was a discussion around his piece, M2A, Cosmotechnics of E-Viscerality. That is also everything that I have for you today. These were two discussions with ArtVolt residents at Eastern Bloc, Diana Matasheva and Ruzbe Shadpei, talking about their work during this residency. Pirate Bloc Radio will be back next month, the first Thursday of the month, between 8 and 9 p.m. here at CKUT 90.3 FM. If you haven't had enough after today's episode, I recommend you to go over to our Mixcloud, where you simply type in Pirate Bloc Radio and you'll find a range of different interviews with artists and local creators. I'll catch you next month. Take care until then.
Thank you. Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Swanee Parolpopolo is back and in real life for its 22nd edition. All the sights, sounds, and sensations of live music. After 2 years of online adaptation, Swanee is filling up the month of June with liberated music of all genres. Over 45 events and 90 participating artists performing indoors, outdoors, streamed for maximum accessibility. Record and book launches, workshops, a puppet show, a satellite Swanee happening in Wakefield, Quebec, of all places. And, of course, much more. For all the goodies, check out SwaneeParolpopolo.org. Masks will, of course, be required. For your audio program guide, tune in to the Montreal Sessions, Tuesday, May 24th, May 31st, and June 7 and 14th, from 3 till 5 p.m. The Swanee crew hosts will be serving up highlights of what to expect at this year's festival. This is, of course, a CKUT co-presentation.
Merci beaucoup, Madame Saint-On.